This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree V.0, the snippet of code that allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards in your mobile app or website, all with a simple, single integration. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to BraintreePayments.com now. Coming up today, why Uber might be forced to hit the brakes in London and what that means for the transportation app in general. Why video games are helping the government find our next generation of security defence, and why launching a website designed to rank and grade every human being in existence might not have been a tremendous idea. I'm your host, Michael Rundle, and I'm editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me are James Temperton.
G'day.
And Cara McGugan.
Hi.
Michael, I have to mention it. It's a significant moment in the life of Michael Rundle.
Go on.
This is your last podcast as Miss Michael Rundle. Next time people hear your voice, you will be Mrs. Michael Rundle.
I'm going to be an honest woman. That's absolutely true. I'm getting married this weekend.
Congratulations.
Thanks, man.
Well done.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. I'm very excited. It's going to be very exciting. Unfortunately, all of my plans to introduce tech into the wedding haven't really come to fruition. I was thinking maybe a drone to record things from above or a robot to hand me the rings. And none
it's
of those
very
have
romantic.
Really come. It would have been, but unfortunately, I'm kind of sticking with the old school stuff. So, you know, a little bit of camera photography here and there, but otherwise pretty much the traditional wedding.
You do have some nice brooches, though.
That's true. Although if the people involved in the wedding are listening to the podcast, I mean, it's good because I know they don't, but... Yeah, no, there's a jewellery maker in London called Tatty Devine, and they make volume knobs that go all the way up to 11 that you can wear as brooches.
I like that they go all the way up to 11.
Yeah, so I'm giving them to a few significant people who I consider to be on Team Rundle. Yeah, I think they're cool. But, you know, other than that, it really is a pretty traditional thing. And I'm taking a week off, which is very exciting. So currently, the podcast next week is you and whoever you can rope into this room.
I'm just going to be shouting into the abyss. So if you want to listen to my internal... stream of consciousness ramblings, then tune in to the next episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast.
Well, anyway, I'll obviously be tweeting all the way through the ceremony. I won't send a single tweet.
Is there a hashtag?
I'm afraid not.
Good. This is
not a social media wedding. This is an offline wedding. But otherwise, I'll be back in a couple of weeks, just in time for Wired 2015, which is also coming up.
That was a beautiful segue.
I know, thank you. It's our annual two-day conference, celebration of all things new in ideas, business, science, tech and design at London's Tobacco Dock near Wapping. And it promises to be a really excellent couple of days. And we'll have loads of coverage on wired.co.uk, live articles written from all the talks, lots of video snippets dropping throughout the day, and obviously all the talks archived on our YouTube page. So even if you're not coming along, although there are tickets available, and if you'd like to find out more, go to wiredevents.co.uk. Then you can follow the event along with us on social media and the website.
October 15th and 16th, and on October 17th, we've got Wired 2015 Next Generation, which is for the inspiring kids of tomorrow to find out all about science, tech, business, design, art, you name it.
Well, follow along or come along. WiredEvents.co.uk and Wired.co.uk. Well, obviously Wired 2015 is taking place in London, and surely a lot of the delegates are going to be trying to make their way there using Uber, but if they're news this week could be anything to go by, that might not be so easy in future, James.
Our Uber. Always the controversial one. So, Transport for London, the organisation that keeps the capital moving, has put together some proposals for new minicab regulations that have annoyed Uber and other similar ride-hailing app firms.
Now, these were leaked proposals, is
they
that
were.
Right? They're not published, you know, policy.
No. So, they're ideas. In as much as any idea is just an idea until it's put into action. So, the proposals, and there's 25 of them, include a minimum 5-minute wait time between ordering a private hire vehicle and it arriving, which Uber might not like because its average wait time is 3 minutes, I think. A ban on app sharing cars for hire. Again, Uber might not like that because it shows you nearby cars that are available for hire. Passengers should be able to book a ride up to 7 days in advance. That's completely not how Uber operates. Drivers should only work for one operator at a time. Most drivers work for other operators and Uber on the side. Impose controls on ride sharing for private hire vehicles. Uber might want to launch a ride sharing service in the UK. A requirement for an English language test. That might be difficult. New training for drivers of private hire vehicles. Uber drivers don't have to be trained. Private hire firms would also have to provide a fixed landline that must be available at all times. Uber doesn't have a landline. All minicab drivers would have to give a specified fare prior to accepting a booking. Uber's fares are calculated by the app.
Now, this reads like a list that was written by black cab advocates. That is pretty much what it is, isn't it?
Their proposals, their suggestions. So you're going to come down on the Uber side of the fence. I'm going to come down on the it's good to have a discussion side of the fence.
Go on. Well, I think that they're pretty targeted at ruining Uber as a useful app. And regardless of what you think about Uber as a political entity or what it's doing to the infrastructure of London, it's a pretty useful app for a lot of people that gets you a lot of places quickly and cheaply. And the idea of a 5-minute waiting time in particular has riled a lot of people up. I mean, I got an Uber the other day. I was standing outside a restaurant. I pressed the button and I could see the car down there and it just drove up and picked me up. It was fantastic. It was like a robot car.
But wouldn't it have been better if you could have seen the car and it had and then, to wait there for 4 minutes?
But I like this idea of a standoff. Like I would have to wait on one side of the street. The car's on the other side of the street and I'm just, you know, we're just eyeballing each other until the 5-minute timer comes up and then I can run over and get my car.
Yeah, it would be lovely. Cara, have you ever Ubered?
I have, yeah.
What do you think of what TfL's suggested, not decided?
Well, I don't really get why it can't be the freedom of the person who wants to take the car to decide whether they want an Uber or a black cab.
It's true. So the counter-argument to that is that black cab drivers are beholden to far stricter regulations than Uber that were specifically designed for them, and the current regulations aren't fit for purpose. So operators like Uber and others, and there are others, we should remember that, aren't...
This isn't the BBC, James.
No. Other Ubers are available. I've lost my point now.
Well, no, but I think the point is that, the reason that black cabs are in trouble as an entity is because they're restricted in the way they operate by the association they have with TfL, in as much as black cabs have been incorporated into the infrastructure of London. TfL monitors and, to some extent, maintains the cab industry, the black cab industry, because we've deemed it a vital part of how London works.
Right, and with that, there's a minimum level of service.
Right, but what that also means is that it's very difficult for black cabs to adjust and improve and move with the times, which is why a company like Uber can be so disruptive and come along and change it. The problem, I think, with these regulations is that it makes it harder to run an efficient service like Uber, but it doesn't make it easier to run a black cab service. If there was a list of new policies that would be, for instance, to introduce Oyster cards into black cabs so you could pay without cash, or that you could see an app where black cabs were around, so if you needed to go and find one, you could walk to where one would be, or to be able to call up a specific black cab, tell it where you are and order it on demand. Those are things that would make black cabs more efficient, but that these do nothing to address. They just make it harder to run a service like Uber.
Michael, you should go and work for the government or TfL.
No, but I think ultimately, although tech people can be callous in as much as thinking disruption is always better, I think making taxi black cab drivers' lives easier would do more in the long run than making it harder to run Uber.
Right. So Uber ain't happy. It's launched a petition calling for TfL to buck its ideas up. It's attracted nearly 120,000 signatures at the time of speaking, and that's in just a couple of days. In an open letter to TfL, Uber said that any new regulation should be putting drivers and passengers first. And to quote, technology that makes it safer and easier to travel around the city should be encouraged, not restricted, quote Uber. Uber also claims TfL's proposals make no sense and threaten drivers' livelihoods.
So what's next in this story? Because obviously this is going to rumble on and on, and it seems like lawsuits are inevitable. But also the mayoral elections aren't that far away, and this is going to be an issue in those procedural debates as well. So what's next for this story?
Much rumbling. A lot of rumbling. It's not the sort of thing that's going to be sorted out overnight. These were leaked proposals. These aren't actual final suggestions. It's going to open up a period of consultation that's going to run and run and run, and it's going to be a very contentious issue, because on one side you've got Uber that is very sure of its position, on the other side you've got the black cabs that are very sure of their position, and it's marrying those two things into an ecosystem that's a bit like the one that you were talking about, Michael, that's going to be the real problem for TfL and for Uber and for black cab drivers. So it's probably going to be messy.
But I love the idea that we would implement these proposals and then in 20 years all of the cars are going to be automated anyway, and yet we still have to have some kind of 5-minute time delay just because we've implemented these regulations 20 years ago. Like, it feels like the direction of history is moving in a certain prevailing direction, essentially, and that this doesn't help that move along.
Regulations, to summarise, are always slower than technology.
To summarise the summary, people are a problem.
Summarise the summary of the summary. Nah! Moving on.
Okay. Kara, talking of future technologies and their interaction with government, you took a trip this week to find out about the future of digital security and some new places that the government might be trying to find the people to keep us safe.
Yeah, so this week, Michael, I went down to Cybersecurity Challenge UK's launch of a new game that is designed to get people excited about cybersecurity and hopefully recruit them into the field.
But this would suggest that people aren't excited by cybersecurity.
Well, I think that there's quite a lack of people in the cybersecurity profession at the moment. Only 0.6% of recent graduates went on to work in cyber in 2014.
And to steal from your notes, by 2020, it's expected that the industry will be lacking in 1.5 million people globally. So something needs to be done, and that's a game, apparently.
Yes, so the premise of the game is that there are 30 million gamers in the UK, and these are the people that are going to be the UK's next cybersecurity experts.
Right.
And so what they wanted to do was create something that would attract those people into the profession. Ergo, a game full of cybersecurity challenges.
Michael, you're a gamer. Do you see your expertise at Splatoon making you an ideal candidate for GCHQ?
I don't know. I think there is a certain extent to which people who are gamers don't recognise that they have skills that can be applied in different areas of technology. So I definitely think that making gamers kind of aware of how applicable their skills could be is probably an interesting thing, a good thing. I think it's a little bit, though, like, 20 years ago when I was at school, they would make video games to try and teach kids maths. I guess that still happens in some limited forms.
But, and you know, weren't they fun?
But kids weren't tricked. That was the point. I mean, like, is this a game that's going to be good on its own, or is this just a kind of semi-sad marketing exercise?
Well, they have created a couple of challenges that involve Minecraft.
Ooh.
So it's a cybersecurity challenge, but within the Minecraft platform. So you go from the cybersecurity challenges game into Minecraft, and there's a whole level in there.
And some of these games were made by really young people.
Yeah, so I chatted with a 12-year-old called Ben, and he designed a whole game on his own.
This is horrendously unfair. I could not design a game when I was 12.
Yeah, I know. And he, you know, there were features in there where he spent a wheelie chair spinning across the room, which was pretty cool as well.
So did it seem like people were excited and upbeat at the event? Or was it slightly creepy and government-y?
Well, there were lots of people there that told me about how Cybersecurity Challenge had helped them get their careers now. And they hadn't necessarily done A-levels or followed a traditional educational route and thought that there was no real career path for them. And doing similar competitions, which were previously available but not in a game form, they then got their jobs. So they were quite excited, but it was all boys.
Really, that's interesting. I mean, because that's something that's come up last week in particular. It was National Coding Week last week. And, you know, it's a big question at the moment how we encourage more young women into technology and areas like this. There were no young women in there at all?
No, the only other woman was another journalist.
Excellent. The diversity is going well then. And this isn't just a game for GCHQ to recruit the next generation of cyber spooks. It's also for security companies and cyber surveillance companies, private firms, to try and get a wider range of people working for them, right?
Yeah, so other companies like ProCheckup and ClearSwift have been working with the challenge to design games, and they're actually going to have recruiters and mentors from their company sitting in the game as avatars.
Hiding.
Interacting with people playing it. And if they see someone that's doing well, they're going to go up to them and be like, "Hi, you might be interested in a job with us." Or so they...
Spooky.
Yeah.
But also kind of cool.
I think it brings up an interesting point, though, doesn't it? That, you know, we have the Next Gen conference coming up, as we mentioned earlier. And, you know, there are certainly a lot of young people who have digital skills and kind of always think about them being a route into business or a job they could do or something respectable and honest and that comes with a paycheck. But not everyone thinks that way. Some, you know, there is definitely a kind of a counterculture element to all digital skills. And that's not just the 90s cliche of, like, hackers trying to reroute the encryptions, you know, hammering away at clicky mechanical keyboards. Like, it's still a big part of digital culture that this isn't, like, it's a kind of a punk thing, basically. But I guess the idea of this is trying to reveal to people that there is a really big world where their skills are in demand
So they're using Minecraft to turn punks into professionals.
Something like that. I mean, that would have made a good headline.
Wouldn't it just?
Talking of earmarking people, this
You're
week,
full of segues.
I am, aren't I? You know, my brain's working today. Click, 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 you know. People, spelt with P-E-E-P-L-E, has been doing the rounds on social media this week. It's a new social network which has caused waves of revulsion amongst the commentariat and probably deserves it, because the idea of people is to be Yelp for all of humanity. So the idea here is that people interact all the time, and most of the people you meet are probably awful.
And this is people with an E-O, not an E-E.
Hmm?
Well, that the app is called People, whereas we are Peopal.
Yes. Well, I did... Nice.
Well, it gets confusing because they've, when you say it, they've named their app the same thing as People.
Okay, I mean, I could just call it People.
Yeah, let's call it People.
Call it People for the rest. All right, that's a good idea. Last thing I would want to do is confuse anyone, because they might give me a bad rating on People. So the idea is that basically, just as with Yelp, if you go to a restaurant, you can give a good or bad review, and that influences how people see the restaurant going forwards. Although clearly in the case of Yelp, people who have a bad experience are way more likely, and research has shown this, to leave a review than people who have a nice experience. The idea is that you would do the same thing for all of the people you meet throughout your day. So if you have a date with someone and it goes badly, you'd give them a bad rating on People, and then people would be less likely to date them in future. Or you have a good professor, or you go to a shop and you have a bad commerce experience, you can rate someone. And now, you know, the creators of the app seem quite convinced this is going to be a mechanism for positivity and social change. But everyone else on the internet seems to recognise this is a recipe for an absolute hell.
I think it's a brilliant idea.
Go on.
Yeah. Well, two out of ten for starters, Michael. I know, right? No, it's certainly an interesting social experiment, isn't it? It's like these things where everyone in an organisation has to display their salary, or people are opening up about themselves in a way that they normally wouldn't.
I think rightly people have pointed out this does seem like a recipe for bullying, shaming, and libel, essentially. Now, the makers of the app have attempted over the last couple of days to kind of consistently bat away a lot of these criticisms. They say that built into the app, there would be a 48-hour waiting period if a negative review was left about your person, in order for you to contact the person and combat the review, and then it would only go up after that 48 hours if you couldn't resolve the issue.
Oh my God, it sounds like the worst thing ever. So you go into a coffee shop and a barista is slightly surly and they don't make you the best flat white you've ever had. So you could leave them a review saying, this barista was slightly surly and made a poor flat white.
Well, not quite, because the app's makers also say that in order to start a page about someone, so to be the first person to review someone, you would need to know their mobile phone number, and also say in your real name how you knew them, whether that was personally, professionally, or romantically.
So let's take this to the logical conclusion. The app becomes tremendously successful, and it's all embedded in tiny little contactless chips that everyone has installed under their wrists. So every time you meet someone, you go, ahoy, tap wrists, and then you can rate them.
Yeah, or you find out what their ratings are. The interesting thing about this is, I mean, obviously there are lots of problems with this, and again, we'll go on to how the apps makers have tried to address them over the last couple of days, but there are lots of apps that already do a version of this. I mean, Uber, we already talked about. A key part of the Uber service is riders' ability to rate drivers and drivers' ability to rate riders, and so that influences both your trust in the driver before you get in the vehicle, or the trust the driver has that you're not going to throw up all over the back seat.
Right. Now you could apply the same thing to everyone you work with, everyone you love, everyone you know.
Yeah, but you know, and the key thing with that Uber information is it's not public. This would be a publicly searchable database that anyone could log on to and find anything.
So we could conceivably end up with the best person in the world, and everyone would know who it is.
Well, again, the apps makers are kind of positive. They would say that this would be a force for good. That more feedback is better, that we can all be better human beings, and that walking around in a state of constant abject terror that someone's going to give you a negative review would be a positive. But you could imagine, again, this is all extrapolating out and also relies on the fact that people would actually use People, which is by no means clear. And it's actually not even clear if it will ever launch at this point, although it does have about $8 million in funding.
What?
So, yeah. So it's not coming out of nowhere. Say you had a job interview and they go along and the first thing they bring up is your People score. And you get a 3.5 out of 5, and you get put to the bottom of the pile through no fault of your own, or maybe someone vindictive came along and gave you a bad review. But, you know, anyway, so the apps makers have kind of addressed some of the criticisms. So they've now said it will be most likely an opt-in service. So you'd have to opt in to receive feedback about yourself. So that's a key difference for a lot of people. You can't just be rated without your knowledge. They also say that unless you are registered on the site, people won't be able to leave negative feedback about you.
Okay.
And they do say that bullying is something they don't want to encourage. It has the feeling of an idea that's actually a bad idea, but that in an odd way, the internet shaming cycle has kind of come around to them while criticizing the people they were targeting for enabling the same thing. It's the classic internet thing of everyone shaming everyone else.
Yeah. Well, before I get on my ranting pony, I'm saddling up. Cara, what do you think? Is people the worst thing ever, or actually quite a clever idea, or neither?
I don't really get why you would need people.
People.
Because you already have LinkedIn for the professional thing, and you can leave references and things on there, and no employer is really going to leave a bad reference anyway. And I think that things like relationships are so personal that I think it's really hard to leave a rating that would then be universally applicable for someone else to go and read that and be like, oh, they were a bad date. And then the third strand, just the on a personal level, I think is, I don't really know what that would be. Like, oh, yeah, he's my mate.
I think that's a good point, in as much as we already leave a huge amount of data about ourselves and our relationships and allow people to form opinions about our personalities, whether we're interesting, whether we're trustworthy, by our interactions every day on Twitter and Facebook and everything else, all of our digital minutiae that we leave across the web. In a way, the idea of boiling it down to a rating is terrifying because it's so brutal, but it's not too much different from, you know, sharing half your personality and expecting a response. If you put yourself out there for a response, ultimately you are going to get one, and it's probably not always going to be one you're willing to receive.
Right. So my ranting pony's now chomping at the bit, so to speak.
It's showing up every week, this ranting pony. Yeah. I feel like we need a couple of sound effects or stings, maybe like a, yeah, or like, you know, the Monty Python two halves of a coconut.
Kind of authentic. Anyway, on their website, people say people will enhance your online reputation for access to better quality networks, top job opportunities, and promote more informed decision making about people. I'm going to take a wild guess here and say that this maybe comes out of the San Francisco Bay Area.
Actually, well, it's been funded there, but this is, I think, Calgary, Canada.
Ooh.
Yeah, well, at least the founders are from that area.
The Wild West of Canada. Calgary's a lovely city. Next to some lovely mountains. I can only say nice things about it, but people I cannot say nice things about. I think the problem here is that it's someone taking a very noble idea that they think would be brilliant. It would really work for them. They'd love to be able to somehow categorize and quantify every part of their life because it would fit into this very neat order that some people in this world seem to want to impose. But it's taking it way too far. It's fine to rate someone on Uber. It's fine to rate someone on Yelp. It's fine to rate someone on TripAdvisor, etc., etc. But it is absolute madness that... After working for Michael 6 months, something like that, I go, yeah, all right, 9 out of 10, 8 out of 10, I'd somehow be able to rate you as a human being.
Well, I mean, that's true. I mean, it also relies on the idea that a good human being is the same for everyone. You know, I might like someone, if I were being served coffee, who was quiet, efficient, and got it done with a minimum of fuss. Someone else might like, you know, a nice long chat about, you know, what the weather was like. People are different and want different things and like different types of people. And also, what kind of maniac would actually go online and leave a review for somebody? I mean,
that's the problem, isn't it?
Well, launching the service is one thing, but the kind of person who would actually go and do that, I mean, it
would be all the people that leave reviews on Yelp.
Well, anyway, this
pub was too noisy. They had televisions in the background, and I don't like televisions in pubs.
And it's always really obvious, I think, that on Yelp, the people who leave agreed reviews are often trying to get the restaurant to respond and then give them a free voucher for another free meal. Again, maybe this is something that this network would enable. You could, if someone left you a bad review, you know, you go around there with a pie or something, or a nice cup of tea.
Let's put this out there. People must have opinions about people. So do get in touch, podcast people. We are podcast@wired.co.uk, @wiredUK on Twitter. Michael, who won't be here next week, but I'm sure would love to have your thoughts on people, is @MichaelRundell. I'm @J2Emberton, and you are?
@CJMagoogan.
Get in touch.
Just don't rate us.
Ooh, no, do. Do rate us. Oh, start God. The madness.
This is tearing us apart. Someone actually did ask us on Twitter how long Wired the Office would last if people existed and we had to rate each other.
It would be a smouldering mess within minutes.
Yeah, let's not try that. Still to come, NASA has lost funding for its asteroid defense program. but has plans to smash one out of orbit anyway, in the same week that the space agency announced the discovery of flowing water on Mars. So how should space agencies pick the missions of the future? We're going to go through some of the options and how that process might work and what our personal preferences for that would be after the break. This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree, code for easy online payments. If you're working on a mobile app or website and searching for a simple payment solution, Braintree V.0 allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards and more, all with a simple integration. Just one snippet of code and you're all set up, ready to start taking payments from customers around the world. For information and to try out the sandbox, go to BraintreePayments.com now. Braintree can't wait to see what you make of it. So, James and Kara, it's been a pretty exciting week for science. Probably the 168 millionth exciting week for science and space in a row. Particularly water on Mars. Now, that was quite a thrill, wasn't it?
I cannot wait to go whitewater rafting on Mars. It's going to be fantastic. Because they have. They found torrents of flowing water, haven't they?
Dribbles, I think.
Dribbles. Salty dribbles.
Seasonal dribbles. I mean, it's not, they didn't find a river on Mars, but obviously the details are all on our website.
But this is what people think. When you say water on Mars, people go, ah, a lake. It's not a lake.
No, it's very, very, very salty brine that kind of periodically, depending on the season, emerges out of the tops of mountains and runs down hills until it quickly sort of evaporates or sinks back into the ground.
But that water's coming from somewhere, and this is why we're all terribly excited. Unless you're Kara.
You don't seem that thrilled, Kara.
I'm not a big space person.
Well, that's terrible.
It's not going to be
your
great
people rating has just gone down at least two.
Yeah,
and it was low already.
God, can you? All right, okay. Just going back to people for a second.
Yeah.
If you had a Google Glass like display and you could see when your thing ticked down,
ooh,
so you could see it in real time,
but you didn't know who'd done it.
Yeah,
just someone within your eyeline. Terrifying. No, it's fine not to be enthused by space.
Well, explain it to me. Why have they only just discovered water on Mars now?
It's quite far away. It takes a while to get there.
It's also true that the rovers that we've currently sent to Mars, so we currently have a couple working robots on the surface of Mars, Curiosity and Opportunity, which has been trundling away for more than a decade, remarkably. But those robots are specifically not allowed to go to the places where scientists have suspected for a number of years that there might be flowing water at different times.
Why?
Because of their radiothermal power generators, which exude heat and would either turn the water into evaporated mist or cause the robot to stop working and explode or do something else terrible to the Martian surface. And even the next rover, which is going to be sent in 2020, can't explore these specific areas. So although, you know, for instance, Mars, we've known, has frozen poles for a very long time, but it's not possible to send rovers there currently with our current technology, which is one of the reasons that sending humans to Mars might be a really good idea.
Like Matt Damon.
Well, I don't think he actually went there, although we did.
No, he did. He definitely did. There were shrubs and everything.
That was something that someone pointed out recently. We have a review of The Martian, the recently released film starring Matt Damon, but the publicity shots that were provided for the review have clearly visible trees.
They hadn't gone through post-production. There was a couple of shrubs, some tire tracks, and what looked a bit like a dirt road. Quite unlikely.
But not a spoiler. But it does seem like, you know, this discovery, one of the really interesting things about it, Kara, is that we could potentially use the water in order to grow crops on Mars. Obviously, you have to treat the water first. But more specifically, to not have to take water from Earth, which would make it a lot cheaper if we could get our hands on some of that water.
You could also use it to preserve meat.
Is that right?
Yeah, well, it's salty water, right?
I suppose so.
Yeah, you could use it to preserve meat, make gravlax, take some vodka up with you. You can make some delicious gravlax. But in all seriousness, it's significant that we suspected that there was water on Mars, but we didn't have proof. And now NASA's 99.999 recurring percent certain that this is water, albeit salty and not much.
Yeah, you know, it's also, I guess, interesting, maybe just quite funny to point out that there is a conspiracy theory that suggests that NASA already knows there is life on Mars and is drip-feeding the knowledge so that we don't lose our minds.
It's the super-intelligent rat people that live in caves, isn't it? Isn't it? They're there, Michael.
Well, if you look on the internet for things found on the surface of Mars or rocks shaped like other things found on the surface of Mars, there's all kinds of stuff. Alien space helmets, frogs, you name it.
But does this enhance our chances of finding life? Is it significant in that regard as well?
Well, scientists point out that basically anywhere on Earth where there is water, there is life. Even in the strangest, most distant, most darkest areas of our planet, where there is water, there is some form of life, or at least the beginnings of something that can emerge into a complex form of life. So we, you know, judging by our experience of our best known habitat, obviously Earth, if there's water somewhere in the solar system, it's more likely that there is life there as well. Water is so crucial that finding water on Mars at least indicates at some point maybe there was some form of life and that maybe we could sustain ourselves there as well.
So speaking of life, let's move swiftly on to death and specifically the death of all humanity as we know it.
That's not people again, is it?
No, it isn't. It would be the death of people, not people, although it would take that with it, thankfully. NASA has lost funding for its asteroid defense program you mentioned earlier. What is that program and why ain't NASA funding it anymore?
Well, the NASA asteroid defense program is actually a really complex and multi-layered thing, and they haven't lost funding for all of it. NASA does a lot of searching for near-Earth asteroids and other objects, rocks, things that fly past us on a regular basis, and elements of that are still continuing. I think in this specific case, the part of the program that lost some funding is the program to land on and redirect asteroids. And this is where it gets sort of complex, and this is really comes down to the US Congress and how NASA relates to that. And NASA has tried to make the case very forcefully over the last a few years that the best thing we can do to stop an asteroid hitting Earth right now, if one was on its way, is pray. That Charles Bolden, NASA administrator, once said that in front of Congress to make the point that there is no current mechanism to deflect an asteroid.
There's no Bruce Willis.
No. But there is, separately announced today, a plan with the European Space Agency to try to redirect at least a moon of another asteroid. So there's a very large moon, it's about 2,500 meters across, which is only ever flies within 4 million miles of Earth, which is not that far, but not that close. A
couple of clicks away in astronomical terms.
Yeah, and this thing has a moon of its own that circles around, it's about 100 meters wide, and it flies around this asteroid as a kind of mini asteroid. And NASA and ESA are going to be sending a mission to this big asteroid and then eventually slamming something into the little one just to see if we can deflect its path. It's nowhere near the kind of technology we would need to deflect an asteroid that could kill a significant number of people, but it's still important. And
so, Kara, space means that we're going to smash a thing into a thing that's millions of miles away. Are you excited?
And maybe kill all of the aliens on Mars.
Aha! Yeah, maybe we could use it to kill the intelligent rat people. But seriously, are you?
Well, now you've put it like that, it's quite exciting.
Smashing things.
It does bring up an interesting point, though, and I think this is where sort of Mars exploration and also this asteroid stuff gets interesting, is that we have a limited amount of money. NASA is critically underfunded, although it still consumes billions of dollars every year. There's only so much they can do. But there are so many potential places we could look for life and other interesting parts of space that we should explore. And, you know, NASA this week picked out five of them, which are going to be competing for an initial round of funding and then potentially up to $500 million, I think it is.
Lots of millions.
Lots of millions to actually launch these missions. But they range from exploring Venus, which, although it's an inhospitable planet, the clouds above it conceivably could support human astronauts, and we could explore that relatively easily. There's moons, Enceladus, which has lots of water on it. Europa, famously, is also pretty much a frozen ball of water. That's really exciting. Mars, if it has flowing water, potentially could support humans. Or should we go back to the moon and try and build a sustainable space base there rather than around the Earth's orbit on the ISS? I mean, there's all kinds of stuff we can do. I guess what I was interested in is what your personal preferences would be.
So we've got a choice of having a poke at Venus, having a poke at some asteroids.
Well, I think the important thing we've got a list here is that some of these have some very cool names. So the first one you mentioned, Venus Noble Gases, that's called Da Vinci. That's a cool name. The Venus Sensitivity Radio Science INSAR Topography and Spectroscopy Mission, Veritas.
Which was also the name of Robert Kilroy Silk's short-lived political party about 10 years ago.
Yeah, so I think we crossed that one off. We've got Psyche. That's the mission to explore the origin of planetary cores. Neocam. Yeah, okay, that's just a new camera. And then Lucy, which is the last one. Which is
a perfectly nice name.
It's a lovely name, yeah.
I think I'd want to go to Venus.
I like Psyche with the violent hit and run.
So, purely going on NASA's three-sentence summaries, they are our decisions. Michael, what is your decision?
Well, I think Venus is the interesting one for me, because all of the... I know that these aren't obviously to prepare for manned missions to Venus, but, you know, hopefully knowing more about Venus would help move that along. Venus is really exciting. And because basically the atmosphere of Venus has a pressure, and but you could explore it relatively easily with human astronauts if you had big sort of secured dirigible that you could float across the atmosphere of Venus.
And so we're talking about putting Matt Damon in a hot air balloon.
It's a cloud
and
city,
him to Venus.
Basically. You could build a cloud city on Venus or above Venus. That would be amazing. And that, to me, is the most futuristic thing. So I'm going to go for a couple of the Venus missions.
So when Ridley Scott comes to make his next space epic, he should call it The Venetian.
Yeah.
And it should be about something that goes wrong. That's not really a spoiler.
All I'm saying is, is there a possibility that there are giant space whales flying over the atmosphere of Venus? Yes.
I think it's entirely likely.
And that we should explore that. What about you, James? What's your personal preference?
I definitely want to go to Venus. I think we've only ever got pictures once from the surface of Venus, and it was remarkable that this craft survived for as long as it did, because it should have been crushed in seconds. I can't remember the name of the mission, but it was in the 1970s,
This was a Soviet mission, I think.
Maybe.
And they literally had a DSLR in a box, and they would open the front of this box and then just wait for the DSLR to be destroyed. And I think they did it a few times, and then the one time it really worked, we got a couple of minutes of footage. But
yeah,
it's pretty amazing footage.
It's amazing, because all you can ever see of Venus is the clouds, and it showed that there's quite an interesting surface there. Are there active volcanoes? Are there rivers of lava? All these sort of things are questions that we really struggle to answer without descending down through its depths. And one of these missions proposes spending over an hour going through the clouds of Venus and down towards the surface, which with today's technology would allow us to get some amazing images and amazing science and research data, which would keep an awful lot of people very busy for an awful long time.
There's nothing living down there, though. You know, where there potentially could be something living on Europa or Enceladus. Cara, are you more interested in aliens? Does an idea of looking for something that actually could potentially swallow a robot snake camera under the surface of the frozen oceans of Europa appeal to you?
Aliens spying on us. That would be exciting.
I'm sensing cynicism. You're really only after the Hollywood headlines.
Well, now I'm kind of scared that an asteroid might come and hit Earth, so I think we should just do the asteroid missions.
Well, NASA would say that there are currently no Earth-destroying size asteroids. They're going to come within, you know, a couple of thousand miles of Earth over the next 100 years. So we should be okay, but we only really scan a very small portion of the sky, which is why the news that any kind of asteroid defense program is losing funding is really bad news, because someone's got to start looking for these. So of them, I think maybe, is it the near-Earth camera, near-Earth object camera? It might be the best bet, because if you look at the stats, it's astonishing how little of the sky we are currently scanning for things that could wipe out all of civilization. And, you know, there is probably nothing we can do, but it'd be nice to know, don't you think?
Absolutely, yeah. And on that note, let's go to people's feedback, people's questions. Michael?
Well, Menashe Peronshik asks about virtual reality. This is a topic to which we return occasionally. He specifically asks if any of us have tried the Virtuix Omni. Now, that's the platform on which you can actually move about. It's like a slippery rubber thing, and you wear these special shoes, and you can walk around in a virtual space, and it kind of tracks your movement.
Right.
Or the Cyberith Virtualizer. I don't actually know what that is.
It sounds
wonderful.
Sounds epic.
He asks if we've tried them, or what our favorite virtual reality system that we have tried is. He also asks us about augmented reality, particularly Microsoft HoloLens. Are there any systems of these that you've tried that have really entranced you? I think I've spoken about before, I particularly love Tilt Brush, which is the position tracking art app where you can draw in midair, which is absolutely amazing.
But yeah,
has anything really kind of got through to you?
I think what's interesting, and particularly about his question, are the weird and wonderful peripherals that are coming up around virtual reality. Some of them are the size of rooms that involve huge mechanized platforms that fly around the room to try and recreate the feeling of either flying or driving or doing something like that. But there's also these weird tilting platforms and seats that do things. And obviously these are going to be really, really niche appeal. But there are going to be some people that are going to be able to set up just ridiculous gaming rigs where they'll be able to do all sorts of improbable things with virtual reality. I've not tried them. I've read a lot about them. I don't think I'd have one in my house. But it would certainly be a fun thing to go and do at a museum to really bring a piece of science or nature to life.
Cara, what about you?
I'd be keen to try one of these virtual reality things that's enclosed within a space and lets you explore more, because my one experience of virtual reality was spinning around on a chair while having a look around.
Menashe also asks, he mentions that he's American. So a good chunk of the excitement of your podcast comes from your accents, he writes. I'm also intrigued by certain differences in pronunciation, for example, the word privacy.
Aluminium, oregano, let's just go over all of them.
I haven't got a pre-prepared list, but I'll try that again. Privacy. Anyway, look, we're running out of time, so we've got to bash through these. We've got a joke here. This comes from Nicholas. He says, the Higgs boson walks into a church. The priest says, we don't allow Higgs bosons in here. And the Higgs boson says, but without me, how can you have mass?
Hey!
You may have even done that one before, but, you know,
worth, I like it.
Worth a go. Daniel Changstein points us towards an intriguing article on the gaming site Kotaku, which seeks to understand why video games cost so much, basically, particularly digital games. And he asks, should digital games be cheaper than physical games?
Right, that's the question that the Kotaku articles... It's really interesting. It's worth going and have a look. Okay. The main...
I don't read any sites other than Wired, James.
No, well, there are other good websites are available. The main thrust of the argument is that if you're going to charge £40 for a game on the high street, you have to kind of charge £40 for that game everywhere, because otherwise the high street won't stock it. And the mistake an awful lot of people make is that, oh, everyone just downloads their games. They don't. Most people still buy physical copies. So while it's definitely going the way of digital downloads only, if you're buying something from EA Origin or PlayStation Network or Xbox Live, it kind of has to cost the same amount as the version that you get as a physical disc from Amazon or Game or Computer Exchange even, I suppose.
2 points. One, they often are cheaper because people wait for digital sales and they're really easy to run through digital stores. So that does affect it. The average selling price is actually much lower for digital games. Two, I think the main cost of games is in the development. So although games cost more to buy in, or cost a lot to buy in stores, to a certain extent, that's the profit that's built in for the infrastructure of buying it in a physical place. But there are overheads too on digital stores. The servers that have to be up to run these things constantly, the updates that come through. You know, there is not like there aren't costs associated. But it's true. I think I bought a game recently, Blood Bowl 2 for PS4. And I was impatient, and it cost £45
on
digital.
I can better that. When I was like 10 or something, I bought Pilotwings 64 from a branch of Woolworths, so this really dates it. I think it was £60.
Wow, that is amazing.
But what a great game, Pilotwings 64. Loved it.
Still playing it. Well, you know, I think we've come to the end of this week's podcast. Next week, as we said, I'm away, so I won't know anything that happens because I'll be on a lovely island somewhere in Greece, hopefully having a nice time. But I'll be back the week after, and as we mentioned, it's Wired 2015, so follow that on all of our social accounts and on wideevents.co.uk. But that's it from us.
Let's say a podcast goodbye to Miss Michael Rundle. Goodbye.
I'm not changing my name.
No, you are. You'll be Mrs. Michael Rundle when you're next on the podcast.
Okay, goodbye.
Good luck.